There's a river somewhere. So much needs fixing around the globe.
Do you draw the line
and next door?
You and I. All that's broken on the river.
It is time for We Act Radio's Conversations Toward Repair. Welcome. You are listening to We Act Radio, broadcasting from historic Anacostia, Washington, D.C., land that was once Nacochtank land, sometimes called Anacostan. The Anacostan people were displaced within about 40 years of Europeans arriving. Anacostia again faces displacement as newer, more upmarket building increases and long-standing businesses and residents find it harder to survive. Displacement is just one form of structural violence considered in this series, Conversations Toward Repair. Another is the historical race-based roots of congressional denigration of the district, putting comfort of those in the national government above the needs of the entire city and using DC and its 700,000 people as some kind of political football. I am Virginia Avniel Spatz, and my intention in starting this series was to address all kinds of violence that we don't always recognize and remark on some of the things that go unsaid so we can notice it and address it and highlight ways to build community and peace. My guest this morning is Kristen Henning, public defender, author of Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth, and professor at Georgetown University School of Law. Welcome. Before we really get into our discussion, I usually begin Conversations Toward Repair with a few words about some historical or current events that are weighing on a lot of us. Today, I note that around the country, young people face extraordinary threats to their education, food and housing access, healthcare, and other aspects of their general well-being and bodily safety as our country is going through, descent into fascism. Locally, grief and concern around the murder of 13-year-old Caron Blake in January is continuing to be an issue as the arraignment this week of the adult accused of shooting the sixth grader in what many people see as an example of the adultification of Black children. And finally, I already kind of mentioned in my intro at the top, the U.S. Senate is poised today to consider a disapproval motion on D.C.'s revised criminal code. And among the thousands of pages in D.C.'s first full revision of the criminal code since 1901 are changes meant to protect minors from violence and threat toward them, and changes meant to reduce over-policing of youth in their communities. So this congressional interference will delay those protections. So sometimes I mention these things just to sort of bring them into our virtual room. Sometimes they come up directly in conversation. Either way, I think it's important to kind of set a context for, you know, where we're coming from. And now I do want to slightly more fully introduce Kris Henning. She works around these ideas that I've already mentioned about laws and enforcement and how they weigh more heavily on Black youth than they do on white youth. She's written a great deal about interaction of race, adolescence, and policing. She trains people around the country to recognize and learn to counter their own biases and to advocate for systemic responses to racial injustice. She is Blum, B-L-U-M-E, Professor of Law and Director of Juvenile Justice Clinic and Initiative at Georgetown Law, where she supervises law students and represents youth in DC Superior Court. Her book, The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth, which is just out in paper, explores the concept of adolescence itself and how it is used to indulge some youth and punish others, and outlines, my favorite part is that it outlines some steps that we can take instead of just saying, well, there's the facts. So I'm delighted to have Chris Henning with me today. And I want to ask first of all, welcome. Thank you so much for taking your time. And if there's anything you'd like to add or correct in what I said at the top, please, this is your opportunity to introduce anything else you'd like the audience to know.
No, I mean, I think you did it beautifully. I'm just happy to be here. I care passionately about young people and have been an advocate representing young people in our courts for 26 years now. And so I'm really pleased that you are elevating these issues. Thank you for having me.
I was really excited to have this opportunity because this book it really did put some things into a better focus for me. And one of the things I thought we'd start with is when I first heard about this book, The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth, I thought, well, you know, it's probably going to tell me some academic things about Black youth and our court system. And, you know, do I really need one more thing like that? But then I opened the book and it was more like reading a memoir or having a long conversation with somebody. You mentioned the word passionate, somebody who's really knowledgeable and passionate about their work. So I wondered if you might want to just say a few words about how the book itself was shaped and what you hope people will take from it.
Absolutely. I mean, you nailed it. I'm a law professor. We are trained to write academic treaties and law review articles. I'm very clear. Nobody wants to read that. Right. And I really wanted folks to know what goes on in our nation's juvenile courts, and especially to know how Black youth in particular are treated differently from the front door all the way through their progress through the system. And so it became clear to me that I needed folks to hear the stories mm-hmm. about real children, real families, real communities that are impacted. And I firmly believe that stories change hearts and minds more than data, more than research. That said, I tell stories, but I back those stories up with the data and with the research. So for the naysayers who think that I am just telling anecdotal stories about, you know, one client or two clients that I had in the District of Columbia, no, I tell a lot of stories, but then I back it up with national research and empirical research as well. And I think the final thing I'll say about the why I chose that format is that I want readers to find themselves in that story, in these stories. And when I say find themselves, no matter what race you are, what class you are, where you live in the city or the country, I want you to see that, hey, I did some of the things that the children in this book did, and I came out just fine. I'm successful. I'm thriving. And so I wanted us all as readers to remember what it was like to be a teenager and then to think about the folks who redirected you without embarrassing you, without criminalizing you, without traumatizing you, without labeling you, but instead showed you love, care, and redirection. And that's what this book is about.
And for those who haven't picked it up yet, the DC library has it. I'm sure your local library has it, and you can get it. As I said, it's now in paper, and I really do recommend it. And there were some things that I guess this conversation will end up being about things that surprised me or that really were new to me or came clear to me. And one of them is this sort of two-part understanding that you just touched on a little bit. And that is that on the one hand, children act with children's brains, right, and we can't really expect them to do otherwise, although, you know, parents and teachers and everybody kind of always has. And the other side of that is that adults probably should know better, are making choices all the time that make it even harder for young people to thrive because they're being kind of asked to do things that just are not in the nature of a child's brain. So can you give us, you know, some examples and tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think you stated it well, this notion that we have to remember that children are children and we should expect children to act like children. There is, now here's where I'll talk about the research. I mean, there is, you know, a plethora of research showing that adolescents are, I could even ask you, I don't know, you don't need to research. Anybody who's listening, who's a parent, who's a teacher, who has worked with kids can give you the keywords that we use to describe teenagers. They're impulsive, they're reactive, they're emotional, they're risk takers, boundary testers. They care a lot about their peers. So peer influence is not a myth. It is confirmed by the research. Teenagers not only do what their friends are doing, they do what they think their friends are doing, mm-hmm. right? So, I mean, we know what teenagers are. I should also note that teenagers are also quite resilient, creative, productive, and smart. But the point here is that because of that impulsivity, there has always been what we call a temporary little crime bump in those teenagers' years, where young people engage in behaviors that technically meet the elements of a crime. But we as a society, from time immemorial, have always recognized that not every behavior that meets the elements of a crime gets treated as criminal. Right. And so that we, you know, when our teenagers talk back and they threaten to do something, we don't arrest them for, you know, a threats charge. When two kids get into a fight on a playground or, you know, tussling over, you know, who gets to play with what toy, we would never call the police on that. Right. The list goes on of things that we do or did as teenagers for which we never end up in court. And so that's a lot of what I want to explain is the normal adolescent behavior. Now, then you talk about, that's exactly right. Society, right? Adults in society, we are making choices, right? That set some children up to fail and that we set some children up to succeed and thrive through that guidance, redirection, support, right? And far too often for Black children, we treat those same normal adolescent behaviors as criminal. And that's what I want to get at. And I can hear listeners out there saying, well, you know, a kid getting in a fight at school or talking back and, you know, making aggressive, you know, behavior or aggressive threats, you know, is one thing. But we're talking about serious violent crime in our city. Well, let me, you know, reveal some things to you that what we call and what we name as serious violent crime should be called into question. And so if you will, Virginia, if I could just give you one story about, I write about her in the book, but I call her Charisse for purposes of the book, but she was a 17-year-old girl, got into an argument with her boyfriend at school. During the course of the argument, she grabs her boyfriend's cell phone and begins to walk away down the hall, scrolling through her text messages to see if her boyfriend had been texting with someone else, because she was convinced that he was cheating on her. A school police officer saw that and decided to intervene. His intervention was to arrest her. So this was a child who's arrested in the hallway, in front of classmates, in front of teachers, and held in detention overnight and prosecuted for, guess what? Robbery. Robbery the next day. So now we have a child on the books, right? Coming into court. You talk about data. And now it looks like we've got this serious violent felon who's a, you know, African-American 17-year-old girl, when in reality, she was a teenager doing what teenagers do. So I think there's a misnomer about, you know, this sort of stark dichotomy between misdemeanor, petty adolescent behavior and serious crime. That is a very blended line, very blended line. And then the final thing I'll say about that is even when, you know, Black youth do engage in serious offenses, right? We as a society respond by penalizing, first of all, we respond by treating that Black child as if they are beyond redemption, as if they cannot be rehabilitated. We're more likely to send them to adult court. We're more likely to impose life without the possibility of parole. We literally throw that child away when they engage in serious violent behavior, instead of doing what we do for white kids, which is rehabilitate them, provide them with services, address the community and the family from which they come, that would have led to that. So that's a huge piece. And then the second thing that we do when we have a Black child who commits a serious violent crime, we treat all other Black teenagers, right, in that community as if they are also criminals. We punish and we begin to label, we begin to target Black children as a class, as criminal, because of the sins of the 1 or 2%. So that's the state of the problem.
Thank you. I do want to get to punishment and police in schools, although I will say those are topics that We Act Radio covers a lot. I want to kind of focus on some things, as I said, that were newer to me, and that I think might be newer to some of our listeners. And one of them is this idea that adolescence was invented. I remember at one point reading a book, and it was actually a novel, and it was talking about how there was a brand new word, teenager. And I remember thinking, you know, in my, like, I was probably in my 20s, and I thought, oh, I guess someone did invent that word and all the things that came with it. But adolescence, as described in The Rage of Innocence, was a, the way you put it, was invented by white middle-class parents to support exploration and formation of identity. Some of the things you've already talked about, you know, that it was meant to let young people experiment, test out boundaries, do things that help them become functioning, happy adults with a good, strong self-identity. But those very same behaviors, and this is what I think really became clearer to me in the book, those very same behaviors, testing boundaries and talking back to adults, or just even trying out new music and clothes and all those things, if you're white or from some particular communities that have a lot of privilege, it's they're just kids. And if you're from places that, as you said, you know, have already been criminalized because we've decided that you have to have a metal detector at all schools with Black children, for example. And for listeners who are in a more diverse place, DC does have diversity, but our big divide, I will just say, is between white people and Black people and white kids. And I raised two of them in the city, so I know whereof I speak, are treated very differently. You know, I guess I'll just diverge for a second to say, my two children, now adults, are fair-skinned white kids with blue eyes, and were only stopped by police if they were with Black friends. If they were with white friends, they were never harassed, never stopped. And starting from, especially my son, starting from when he was little, because he was I guess he was young, but he was a big kid. And if he was with Black friends, that they were treated very differently than if he was with white kids. And he noticed it really early on. I digress, just in part to say, you know, we live with a very specific set of divides here in DC. And I know they play out other places. And your book, mentions Cleveland and St. Louis and many other places where that same divide is there. But there's other places where Native children or Pacific Islanders or Latina children are and that happens here too. Anyway, I'm always kind of trying to speak to some specifics in DC and also to, you know, national things. But, you know, I started to ask about this idea that adolescence is an invention, and it is used to kind of bludgeon Black teenagers, at least here in DC, and in the experience that you shared with your years in the public defender's office. But how can we address that? Like, can we change the laws? Can we change policing? Change the way people think about young people?
Yeah, so you're sort of thinking about solutions, though. So yes, I just wanted to affirm this idea that, you know, even before I talk about solutions, that adolescence, I think I, at my age, always took it for granted that development evolves over three stages: childhood, adolescence, and adulthood. That is a very new concept, or a relatively new concept in historical perspective. It wasn't until really the mid 50s that you even see the word adolescence, you know, infiltrate and become like a popular term. And so indeed, as you said, you know, Virginia, it's a privilege to enjoy those years of adolescence. Before the Industrial Revolution, you know, children were out in the field and, you know, had work responsibilities for the family and for the community. And then with the Industrial Revolution, we've got new jobs, new manufacturing, factoring jobs that require skills and advanced education. And so it was the wealthy and white folks who were able to first bring their children in from the field and put them in schools and prepare them to get these new jobs in this changing, you know, economy. And Black and brown children didn't get those opportunities. So this opportunity, this extended period of education, extended period of free time, right, away from the field and from work, led to this creation of adolescence. And so adolescence is almost, you know, really been reserved for white wealthy children until we had mandatory school attendance and labor laws that brought everyone in, you know, from the field. And today, with the criminalization that we're talking about, like the ways in which Black children aren't allowed to enjoy those periods of play. And I think your story, Virginia, this contrast between when your kids, your white children walk out and enjoy the parks and they enjoy walking down the street, they enjoy maybe, you know, sitting outside and laughing and talking, they go uninterrupted. That's an important part of adolescent free time. Whereas Black children are much, much more likely to be stopped, frisked, much more likely to come in contact with the police or some other state actor asking them, where are you going? Where are you coming from? So I really wanted to just, I wanted people to hear that. It really matters, this opportunity for recreation, leisure, and play during adolescence is actually what makes us thrive and grow into healthy adults. So what do we do about it? I mean, that's the big penultimate question. I mean, I think there's so many things, honestly, Virginia, that need to happen, some of which, and it just depends on where you live, you know, in the country, some of which we need to literally decriminalize some typical adolescent behaviors, right? And so when we talk about decriminalizing in some states, like in Maryland, for example, there have been statutes on the books that make it a crime to disturb schools, right? South Carolina, up until very recently, had a statute on the books. Mm-hmm. It's a crime to disturb schools. What does that mean? It's a crime to be a teenager. It's mm-hmm. a crime to like interrupt class, to act out and to get into an argument with your boyfriend at school. All of those things, anything falls under that umbrella. So that's just an example. Some of it is about the application of indeed, you know, school fights. I don't want kids fighting one another, but we're not talking about stabbing one another. We're not talking about, you know, pulling a gun and shooting someone at school. We're talking about boys, you know, or girls or folks who, you know, don't subscribe to either, you know, male or female gender, getting into scuffles at school. That's what teenagers do. So decriminalizing the application, right, of that criminal law, of the simple assault to children, fighting with children, those kinds of things. Thinking about, you know, sexting, that's a new terminology across the country, is a crime on the books, sexting. So in other words, you know, if you text, you know, an inappropriate picture of oneself as a teenager to another teenager, not pornography, by an adult preying on a child. I'm talking about two teenagers consensually, you know, passing, you know, explicit photographs. That's a crime in some places, right? And look, we're not saying children don't need intervention and guidance and redirection and education. We're saying those behaviors should not be criminal, right? So I could go on, you're talking about examples. That's one, decriminalizing certain adolescent behaviors is one. I think another one is, and this is important in the District of Columbia, but thinking about ways in which we can reduce the footprint of police officers in the lives of all children, and especially Black and brown children who are disproportionately overrepresented. And I want to be super clear, this is not at all an anti-police conversation. I'm just not having that conversation. What I am saying is us being thoughtful about where police officers are needed, where they are trained to be present, and where they are actually, effective, most effective, and then relieving them of those duties and responsibilities that, quite frankly, a lot of them don't want to do anyway, right? And shouldn't want to do, but where they're not adequately trained. One of them is regulating the behavior of normal adolescents, right? So, we don't need police officers to intervene in mental health crises, generally speaking, right? We don't need, police officers to be called to the scene of a drug addiction. We don't need police officers, regulate children's playtime, that kind of thing. Think about who do we need in spaces, right? So it's a reallocation. One of the solutions is reallocating, not talking about defunding the police, but reallocating resources. So increasing resources, money spent on a continuum of mental health services, both in the community and in our schools, right? Creating better resources for recreation for our young people, creating vocational opportunities for our young people so that they have, they use their free time in ways that earns them money, that makes them feel good about themselves, that teaches them a skill. That's how you get people, young people to avoid crime or disengage from criminal behavior. I'll pause there, but those are just a couple of the ideas, and there are more.
Just when young people need the most support.
That's right.
Then Black children especially are cut off from all kinds of support. And, I guess I was trying to think, trying to separate out policing from what the expectations of the community. And here, here in DC especially, but we see it all over the country. And this whole thing with the Senate taking up our criminal code is partly about the perception of threat and danger and how that informs the identity of these That's kids right. who really could be thriving. And not that Black children are not thriving and surviving That's in many places, but we are making it way harder than need be for a lot of them, especially when we're making it harder for the people who have the least resources to respond. And so things that you said about redirecting resources so that communities are building up their young people, we're supporting our young people rather than turning them into part of this perceived criminal situation, which, we're hearing. You also touched on the idea of getting a criminal record, which, even if it's expunged when they become adults, kids have already been exposed to things that are not in favor of their self-identity development. And that was one of the things that just came through so clearly to me in this book. Like I said, some of the facts weren't new, but the way it was presented really made it hit home to me in a different way. And, I'm thinking you said at the very beginning that you wanted people to recognize themselves in some of the teenage behaviors that are going on. And I also found it really instructive to recognize some of the incidents in the book. Sadly, there's two stories about young people in DC as young as 9 who were detained by the police, and how right. that happened, and it wasn't far from my home. And so it, seeing it in a context, actually really was helpful, instead of making you feel like, oh, this is just, there's so many things to correct and we can't do anything. It made me feel like maybe we could understand it and address it. So I hope it makes other people feel that same way. And before we move on, I do want to remind listeners that this is We Act Radio, broadcasting from historic Anacostia, Washington, D.C. I'm Virginia Avniel Spatz. And the other voice you hear is Chris Henning, who is a public defender, professor, and author of The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth. And I was going to go into talking about punishment, but before I do that, there's a very specific thing that also was like kind of eye-opening for me about the idea of incarceration, that you said in the book that there's a lot of research about, well, there's a fair amount of research about parents and children, but there isn't a lot of research about what happens when one sibling is incarcerated.
That's right.
And I wondered if you wanted to say something else about that, or if maybe someone has actually done more research on it. No.
Yeah. There's been very little on this. We like you said, we spend, there are books, whole books written on the impact of parental incarceration on children. It's an important topic that should be studied. But what is woefully understudied is the impact of a child's incarceration on the entire family. Mm-hmm. And in particular, I highlight the ways in which a child's incarceration impacts siblings, right? And that we don't see, we really have to understand every choice that we as adults in society make in responding to what is, you know, an adolescent criminal behavior, right? Again, I'm really talking largely about adolescent typical behaviors that we decide to prosecute as criminal, that every choice that we make in that regard has a much broader impact. And so we have to understand the psychological trauma that their siblings go through and how that psychological trauma impacts that sibling's ability to succeed and thrive in life, how trauma impedes one's ability to focus and pay attention at school the next day. It impacts a child, in this case, the sibling's ability to engage with other legal authorities that they might encounter in their lives. They begin to become fearful and resentful of the authority figures who look like the police officers or the other law enforcement officials who took their sibling away. Another thing that happens to siblings is they begin to be labeled. And I'm telling you, I've seen it right here in the District of Columbia, that one sibling gets arrested and everybody in that community, right, not, you know, begins to see the siblings, oh, you're just like your brother. And so any wrong move, they get no grace, they get no tolerance, they get no support. Instead, I know you're headed straight down the path like Johnny did. Mm-hmm. And we really, you know, have to be careful about how we are setting our young people up, you know, to fail. You made some really good points. And I definitely talk about this in the book, that the adolescent years are the most important developmental times in our lives, second only to what we call the 0 to 3. Of course, we know what happens in 0 to 3 years is really critical, but those adolescent development years are the second most important times in our development. And so the ways in which we respond to and treat and message to our young people about their value and their worth has a profound impact upon how they're going to grow up to be as adults. And, you know, there is empirical research demonstrating that young people, particularly young people of color, Black and Latino youth in particular, who live in heavily surveilled neighborhoods, who have frequent contacts, frequent stops and frisks with law enforcement officials, really begin to question themselves, right? This is that adolescent identity formation that you talked about and that I talk about in the book. And what I mean, that's just a fancy way of saying they begin to question who they are, who they can become, whether or not they fit into the rest of society. And at its absolute worst, they begin to question the legitimacy of, you know, law and law enforcement that they can see with their own eyes is treating them differently, treating them, you know, in ways that are racially disparate or that they just know are unfair. Like, I am being stopped and I didn't do anything. Even if Ronnie, you know, down the street, or even if Ronnie 2 feet away from me, you know, committed a crime, why do I get stopped in that, right? And so you have to understand that kind of impact on a child during these adolescent development years. And so siblings, right? We talk about the impact on siblings. You're watching that. You know, the research on trauma shows that trauma occurs from witnessing or hearing about, you know, moments of police violence, you know, even, you know, moments of police violence, like on television, right? That they see, that has an impact. And watching, just to be really clear about this, two strands of research. Research shows that watching or witnessing your friends and your family members, right, be aggressively attacked or approached, if you will, by the police or by civilians has a profound impact on the child. In addition, there's a body of research talking about how young people watch on television these high profile incidents, right, of police violence and suffer from trauma, hopelessness, depression, anxiety, fear, hypervigilance, meaning that they're always on guard, not trusting adults. And so what I say when I talk to police officers, again, this is not an anti-police conversation. It is the reality that those high profile incidents mean that when you approach a child, that your blue uniform carries with it a history of both historical tension between Black communities and the police, but also contemporary tension and anxiety. So even when you mean well, even when you're out on a wellness check, you have to understand and appreciate the anxiety and the trauma that a young person is experiencing. And so it's absolutely critical that we reduce, you know, unnecessary, right? Unnecessary contact between police officers and young people.
So I know you don't want to talk about a sort of like removing police from schools exactly, but I had a guest last week, Brandon Anderson of the organization, a national organization called Rahim, which is dedicated to building infrastructure, which focuses on reimagined safety.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things that I think we would more profitably manage as a city and a country is if we talked about safety that was not, like, too many people were taught that police equal safety when in fact
correct
many people that, you know, that isn't true. And in some ways I feel like I was blessed because I grew up with a father who was not taught us not to really trust police. I grew up in Chicago at a time when the
police
were pretty it was a good cautionary note, and it has formed my life, so that, not that I haven't called the police at some points in my life, but that idea that it's like a knee-jerk response. I don't feel safe, so we'll either call the police or we'll call for more police, which is what we're seeing here,
right,
in DC in some ways with this revised criminal code argument. And if we could learn to talk about safety in ways that meant, you know, young people get the supports they need to grow into full centered human beings instead of being constantly pulled off. I mean, one of the things that that I think it's really hard for people who live in pockets of DC where there's a lot of privilege and less police.
That's right.
And less gun violence is that, you know, some of our children are in trauma every single day from crime that they witness out in the street, from the fact that they heard gunfire all night, from many other things that are going on. And we tend to talk about schools as though they're like this isolated little thing. Yeah, like we talk about school safety, but we don't talk about what happens to the kids once that bubble of safety disappears, assuming there was one, and they're back out on the street with, you know, whatever issues are still on the street. So your book does talk a lot about other things that we need to address so that we're not treating like a good healthy childhood like something we can fix with very specific laws about policing or guns. And I know I'm kind of jumping around, but I wanted to give you an opportunity to say more things from your book that would help us build a safer society without focusing on policing. Well, and of course we do have to address guns.
Right. So let me just say, I just want to be really clear, you know, if anyone ever asked, I am in favor of police-free schools, you know, just because that's not, you know, sort of the focus of this particular conversation. But no, and the reason, look, I support police-free schools is not as radical. I always tell people it's not as radical as that sounds. Basically, it's really what you said and what it sounds like, Raheem, your previous guest talked about. It's the ways in which we have bought into the narrative that the only way to be safe in our society is traditional law enforcement strategies, surveillance equipment, guns, and police officers. Well, look, why are we using guns to teach other people not to carry guns? I mean, like, those are some of the basics, right? Also, I think about, you know, community members as an African-American, woman myself, and thinking about, I want to be safe too. Black parents want their kids to be safe too. So this isn't like, you know, Black versus police. The point is that if the city or the state is only funding one thing, which is police and surveillance, then I'm going to take that, right? You give us one option, mm-hmm. we take what's given mm-hmm. to us. And that's why, you know, you hear even within, you know, Black communities that are most impacted, you're like, oh, give us more police, you know, protect us. And then you also hear it from white communities. That's because you're giving us no other options. If we as a community, and this is about the reallocation of funding, right? If we would meaningfully fund these alternatives, meaningfully fund a public health strategy for school safety and community safety, then we would all be better off. And when I say meaningfully fund, I mean putting in real dollars in it and allowing for what we call trial and error. So what happens, I think, in our city is that we, let's say, you know, the mayor or somebody will commit the dollars to mental health in schools. But the second some high profile incident happens, we want to, you know, pull ourselves back from that. And that's the problem. We don't stay the course. We don't follow out best practices. So what does a public health approach look like? It's it is one that is trauma informed. You talked about it. So many children today, right, are growing up with trauma, trauma from violence in their neighborhood, trauma from, parental poverty, family poverty, trauma from the pandemic now, all the things, right? Trauma from watching the political unrest and racial unrest in this country. You know what I mean? So we traumatize children. We as adults, society, we traumatize children. And then they pick up whatever they can to defend themselves, a gun, a knife, and we then, you know, punish them. So it's for doing that. It's a horrendous, vicious cycle. You know, and so my point here is we have to have a public health approach. So that's a trauma-informed approach, a restorative approach. Restorative seeks to bridge relationships that have been broken. It's got to be a public health approach also needs to be cultivating meaningful, healthy relationships between adults and children. Right. With mentors and teachers and all of whom who really care about those kids. It also a public health approach has to be racially equitable because of what we talked about further. Right. Like children are fairness fanatics. So if I see you treating me differently, you're undermining, you know, all, you know, everything that I think about law and justice and society. On a much more practical level, when I think about a public health approach, it is some of the things we've talked about: a continuum of mental health services, vocational opportunities, social emotional learning in the schools, smaller class sizes, behavioral support persons in the classroom. I'm all in favor of teachers having the support they need, but the support that teachers need isn't, the school resource officer. And I say this across the country: teachers pick up the phone and they call the school resource officer to come in and deal with adolescent misbehavior because that's all they're given. If we had, psychologists or therapists or counselors, I should say, is probably, but licensed counselors who were trained in developmental de-escalation, developmental conflict resolution, developmental, skills needed for social emotional learning as our behavioral tech support, then we wouldn't need police officers to come in to the classrooms and to do those kinds of things. And so I think all of that is what we're talking about: alternatives, to policing. When we talk about reimagining safety and alternatives to policing, it's not an anti-police. It's reserving police for those small set of things that they are best equipped to do. And I got to tell you, they're best equipped at solving crime, for the most part. They're better, let's put it this way, they're better at solving crimes after the fact than preventing crimes, right? We've seen across the country that police presence in schools does not prevent mass shootings, right? So thinking about how do we prevent mass shootings, we prevent mass shootings and school violence, and we reduce gun violence by supporting kids, supporting families, and supporting communities with all that they need: economic research, job opportunities for their parents, right? Safe, affordable housing, right? Medical health care so that a kid can walk in off the street and get counseling without coming through the juvenile legal system. It just burns my heart. Like I said, I've been representing kids in the District of Columbia for 26 years. We use the juvenile legal system, our juvenile courts, to dole out social services. It is appalling as a city. It's not a critique, of the court system trying to do what they think is best in the moment. By the time we get kids to court, we ruin them, right? Like, give them those services in the community so that they don't end up with us labeling them and treating them like criminals.
So we're coming, unfortunately, close to already the time when you have to move on to go to the courts. And I kind of hate to bring this up, and if you decide that you'd rather go with something more positive, we can do that. But I was very struck by one of the things that you said about vigilante killings, that I'm quoting, they send an unmistakable message that Black youth should not overstep the boundaries of whiteness preserved by iron gates, suburban dividing lines, and request to turn down their music. Vigilante violence is particularly effective against adolescents as it seeks to impose limits and boundaries before their identities are formed. That's the end of that quote. And I did want to give you an opportunity, if you want to say, how do we address this? Is it a matter of educating white people? What do we do?
Yeah, I mean, this is such an important point that I say to folks also all the time, that when we talk about policing in our country, we're not just talking about police officers in a blue uniform. We are talking about all of us, civilians, all of us who, perceive and presume that a Black child or a group of Black children will be criminal. The ways in which we weaponize 911 to keep people out of our neighborhoods, not in my backyard. And some of that, to be quite frank, has a legacy of preserving power, resources, and opportunity for one class of people to the exclusion of another, right? So when you see a Black person in your, in a predominantly white neighborhood, you call the police as two children out of place, right? But what do we do with it? We know sort of deep down somewhere that that's not quite right, that we shouldn't be doing that. And so what do we do? Our subconscious tells us that these kids are dangerous. This is the legacy, right, of racial bias in our country. It started off in very explicit ways, right, during the era of slavery, during the era of lynching, even during the 1990s, the language and the narrative about how dangerous, you know, Black people and Black children were to white America was explicit. Now we have a lot less of that sort of explicit, though it's resurfacing, you know, in its own way, but we have it in this implicit way. So I say to folks, and I say this, look, you know, to white folks and people of all races, including Black folks, right, that you walk down the street, you walk through a park, you see a group of kids, you have to ask yourself, am I nervous and why? Why did these kids do anything, you know, that would support this, right? Or have I just bought into that narrative? And so that goes to this vigilante violence, right? The presumption that a Black child is going to do something criminal. So that's one whole piece of it. And that, yes, it's about a cultural shift. It's about, you know, part of why I wrote this book is like letting you know, the world see, you know, Black children are just children too. They do all this silly, stupid, you know, improper things that white kids do, but they're also fun and creative and resilient and all those things. So I want us to see, you know, Black kids in all of the dimensions, right? So that's part of the work, is all of us. The other thing is, you know, getting proximate to young people, right? So that white folks, if they want to, you know, learn and you want to be less afraid, you know, of Black kids, you got to get proximate, like meaning volunteering at a local recreation facility, you know, providing a job, summer internship for a young Black child who would otherwise, quote unquote, you would consider at risk, you know, so that you can get to see and know these children for whom they are. So everyone needs to get proximate to other kids. Also, too, this whole notion of vigilantism, like what are we as a country going to do, right, about holding, you know, white folks accountable? And I'm very clear on the irony of this, right? I want to reduce the criminalization of all of all children, right? Of all races and all classes. And I want to, you know, reduce the criminalization of our country. But notice that we are quick to hold Black kids accountable. We don't hold, you know, white vigilantes or non-Black vigilantes. And I'm thinking about, you know, Trayvon, you know, Martin's, you know, killer, even though he wasn't, you know, white, he was mixed race. But we don't, you know, who doesn't get held accountable, you know, all the way from the era of Emmett Till, right? You know, when Emmett Till was, you know, was killed, you know, the jury, you know, let his killers walk out. We think about, you know, the killings of Black kids by police officers, by civilians goes unaccounted for. And I really, you know, the Kayron Blake, you know, narrative. And it's also Black on Black. I mean, we have bought into the narrative, you know, of criminalizing Black folks. And let me be clear, I'm not weighing in on whether, you know, Kayron, you know, was tampering with that car or tampering to steal with the car. But I am very, very clear that we don't kill people. We don't kill children to teach them that stealing is wrong, right? And so, you know, what is it that leads to that kind of killing of Black children, like Tamir Rice playing with a toy gun, even if we thought, you know, mistakenly that he had, you know, a real gun? How do we respond? You know, why are we not de-escalating? Why are we not getting ourselves to a place of safety and asking those children, engaging with those children, right? Think about, and look, you think about Kyle Rittenhouse, right? Kyle Rittenhouse was walking in open public view with a rifle of some sort on his body, you know, for an extended period of time. Now, people will say, oh, it was Wisconsin and, you know, there were open carry laws. I'm sorry. You know, look, this kid, had it been a Black kid, had Tamir Rice been in Wisconsin, he still would have been shot dead. Don't fool yourselves into believing that that's not the case, right? Had Kyle Rittenhouse been tampering, excuse me, had Kayron Blake, you know, been tampering, you know, with an auto in another state, you know, and had been white or had been in Wisconsin tampering with the car, he wouldn't have been shot. I'm sorry, very articulate. You know, I get sort of passionate, but you know what I'm saying? That the race matters in how we respond. And that is about the dehumanization. That is the devaluing of life, right? So that, you know, you've got a child committing, even if they are committing a crime, right? First of all, there's the presumption of criminality, right? And so that many children are getting shot when they're not engaged in criminal conduct. But even when they are engaged in criminal conduct, we then presume that it must be a gun involved, or that it must be some serious violent offense. That's another presumption that we're often wrong about. And then the third layer is, even when it is, you know, something serious, and, you know, how do we intervene? We intervene differently in that moment with a Black kid than a white kid, right? Mm-hmm. It was Kyle Rittenhouse who took lives, not and nobody took Kyle Rittenhouse's lives, even though he's walking about, you know. Mm-hmm. The irony is just not lost. And it's not just irony, it's tragedy. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to own that. We want to talk about the crime narrative, and we want to, you know, Black kids have become violent, and we've got to protect ourselves and our city. And we have these moments of temporary uptick in carjacking, a temporary uptick in gun violence for a moment. And we forget that this, again, we are penalizing, you know, the community of Black children for the sins of the one or two. And I cannot say this enough. It is just as important that we get it right for the suspects as we get it right for the victims, right? That we got to get it right for everybody. If we get it wrong in adolescence and how we respond, we're hurting the victims, we're hurting the kids, and we're hurting public safety writ large. The research is clear that if we, you know, criminalize, we penalize, we incarcerate, we over police, we over arrest, we are actually increasing crime rather than reducing crime. And people, it sounds counterintuitive to people.
Well, thank you. I do realize that you probably have to run. If you have any last comments, or I will put links to organizations and to research that you mentioned in the book. Anything you'd like, any closing words?
Yeah, I think my closing words are, just remember that Black children are children too, and that we have to treat all Black children like children. We have to treat all children like children. You know, this is, you know, people want to debate about, you know, Black lives matter and the like. Here's the deal: all lives do matter, including Black children, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what I want to leave folks with, and that I want to. I often, if people have heard me speak before, I often like to end with the idea that a psychologist friend once taught me, which is that every single child is entitled to or needs at least one irrationally caring adult in their lives. And that a child, all of the children in our country and in our city, would do better if they had a team of irrationally caring adults. That means adults who recognize that teenagers will be teenagers. They're going to make mistakes, you know, go off the beaten path, but we don't embarrass them, demonize them, humiliate them, criminalize them. We show them love and support and redirection. And that's what we've got to do. And even when we, you know, have to remove them temporarily from society, we do so in ways that are humane, that are racially equitable, and that are rehabilitative, right, for young people. And there's evidence-based strategies to intervene in the lives of even the most serious repeat offenders, without, you know, treating them, without forgetting that they are still children.
That's wonderful. That was the voice of Kristen Henning, who is author of The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth, a public defender and professor at Georgetown University School of Law. Thank you so much for this wonderful conversation and for all the work you're doing. I'm just delighted, and hope people run out, get your book, and then start enacting some of the suggestions that you have in it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me and for having this conversation.
Again, that was Kristen Henning, who is author of The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth, professor at Georgetown University Law, and a public defender for more than 25 years in the District of Columbia. Thank you to Professor Henning for joining Conversations Toward Repair on We Act Radio today. I have a couple of announcements before closing. We Act Radio co-founder Kimon Freeman published his first novel, Nineveh, A Conflict Over Water. It will be officially released later this month. In advance, a series of book talks are scheduled, co-sponsored with Busboys and Poets. The next book tour events are March 12th, when Sunny Sumter, president and CEO of the DC Jazz Festival, joins the author to discuss Nineveh, A Conflict Over Water at the Shirlington Busboys and Poets. March 19th, playwright and producer Ari Roth will lead a discussion at Busboys and Poets in Anacostia. Other events scheduled to discuss the book will be with Melanie N. Douglas, Kojo Namdi, and Andy Shalal. Visit NinevahNovel.com to get more information about the book and about the events. That's Nineveh, N-I-N-E-V-E-H, Novel, N-O-V-E-L, NinevahNovel.com. And one more announcement is that the Council Office of Racial Equity is hiring both a summer fellow and a fall fellow. The core team, which has been in operation for only one full council period, has completed almost 160 racial equity impact assessments, some of which have been discussed in some detail in Conversations Toward Repair. CORE is seeking more help and invites applications for paid fellowships for people committed to racial equity who have outstanding writing, editing, research, analysis, and communication skills. Fellows will conduct research, contribute to CORE community engagement strategy, and develop policy analysis skills. No particular educational requirements in place for this position. Visit dcracialequity.org. That's dcracialequity.org for application and more information about that important office here in the District of Columbia. I'm Virginia Avniel Spatz. This is Conversations Toward Repair on We Act Radio, broadcasting from historic Anacostia, Washington, D.C. Peace.